It's Tuesday, March 1st, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Well, America's still talking about the Academy Awards. Let's go back to Sunday night, and there in Los Angeles, what was fascinating about the event on the first level was how normal it seemed to be. And that is to say, how apolitical. With all the things going on in the world, it is so easy for Hollywood to stoop down and try to take political advantage. But there were almost no political comments made in the course of the entire event. It was also one of the shorter of the events. And as America's entertainment culture and its celebrity obsession comes together in this one night, which is something of an absolute festival of everything that makes the entertainment culture what it is, it was fascinating. And I hope that we as Christians can understand this, that some things came shining through in ways that were unexpected. One of them was, for instance, how much we really long for moral character. When Colin Firth won as the best actor, he won it for the movie that won the greatest number of awards. That is, of course, The King's Speech. And Americans were drawn to that probably for many reasons. Number one, most Americans are Anglophiles of one sort or another. So you bring in the British royal family and you have immediate American interest, perhaps in a way that exceeds even the interest of many in the British Empire. But beyond that, there is also the sense that there is a story of significance here. The story of the Duke of York, who became George VI. The story of how he became king is at least a part of the background of the story of The King's Speech, the main purpose of which is to tell the story about him attempting to overcome and largely succeeding in overcoming the problem of stammering and stuttering as he had to take on his kingly responsibilities. But that's what I hope we're focusing on. If you go back to the actual historical man, George VI, and you go back to his moment, you have to understand that this was not a matter of overcoming public embarrassment. It was a matter of a man fulfilling his role that millions depended upon. If you go back to the statements made in the movie by George V, his father, you'll recall that as he spoke to his son, he spoke to him about what was incumbent as a responsibility upon the reigning family of England, upon the throne, upon the House of Windsor. It had to do with the fact that the world was in tumult at that midpoint of the 20th century, that the British Empire, as it then existed, was dependent upon a monarchical symbol of not only royal prestige and authority, but of tradition and culture and social identification. And the reality is, as George V says in that movie, we now have to speak. They now have to be visible. In the age of radio, which all of a sudden meant this new technology, the king would have to be heard. And in order for the king to be heard, he would have to be able to speak. George VI was not born to be king. His elder brother, of course, became Edward VIII. And we know the story of that moral tragedy. But, you know, as much as it was a moral tragedy at the individual level, as we understand the providence of God in history, it was an absolute wonderful thing that Edward VIII was removed as king and that someone with the moral credibility and the kingly heart of George VI then took the throne. Took the throne, you'll remember, when the British Empire was at its most vulnerable, when, as Winston Churchill himself said, they were ready to fight on the beaches, wherever, but they had almost nothing with which to fight. It was the moral resolve of George VI, coupled with the moral resolve of Winston Churchill, that largely helps to explain how Britain was able to hang on when everything was stacked against it, when Operation Sea Lion was an operational plan by Hitler to invade the British Isles, and when, let's remember, the United States was watching this conflict from safe distance across the Atlantic Ocean. So when Americans watch that, I think many Americans like it because – again, they're Anglophiles. They love the tradition. They love the costumes. They enjoy the acting. And, of course, they love the story of an individual overcoming this kind of great obstacle and challenge. But I want us to remember that there's always more to it than meets the eye. I think the reason a lot of Americans are drawn to that story is because they know it really did make a difference. It made a difference in history. When George VI stood up to make that speech about why England was now at war with Hitler, it made a difference in history. And it really mattered that he was able to speak. There's a lot going on in the world right now. Of course, the big question has to do with what's going to happen in Tripoli. The four-decade-long tyrannical regime of Muammar Gaddafi, the Iraqi strongman, seems to be coming to an end of one form or another. But it's very interesting to know that the end that this one's going to come to is likely to be not a very positive end at all. A couple of things to remember. when last I spoke on this briefing about Muammar Gaddafi, I pointed out the fact that he holds himself to be the representation of the general will of the people. And that's generally the way dictators think. And the problem is that there's nothing between Muammar Gaddafi and the people. You know, one of the interesting things that I found most fascinating in the reporting over the weekend about the situation in Libya is the fact that Muammar Gaddafi has troops, but he never trusted his troops enough to give them bullets for the guns. He gave them the guns, but he wouldn't give them ammunition. He didn't even trust his own army because he was afraid that they would turn, of course, on him. Well, it looks like this is coming to a very bitter end. The reports are coming out indicating that Tripoli is now largely surrounded by opposition forces and that Gaddafi is down to just several thousand troops, whether they have bullets or not. And the reality is that that there's a clock ticking almost assuredly on his rule. But that leads to the question, what next? And here we need to be reminded of the fact that civil society, that civilization requires certain institutions, the absence of which means that there's nothing but anarchy. And of course, when anarchy occurs, it never lasts. What comes behind anarchy is going to be some kind of order. And if history goes as history so often has gone, what you're going to have is another strong man or another transitional strong man or a more democratic transition that leads to yet another strong man. Because as it turns out, autocracy has an enormous holding power. And why does it have holding power? It's because autocrats are very good at preventing the arise of the kind of institutions that would make an alternative to autocracy possible. The New York Times did a very good job of detailing this in recent days when it pointed out that after the fall of the former Soviet Union between the years of 1989 and 1992, so many of those lands that were liberated from Soviet oppression are now under some other form of oppression. And that's just, again, another picture of a Genesis 3 world. Speaking of a Genesis 3 world, one of the things that has been so often remarked about these revolutions, especially in Tunisia and Egypt, is how young the revolutionaries are. These are college students by and large or recent college graduates. One of the things that has animated them is a lack of opportunity. The Arab world is the only part of the world in which having a college degree means you're less likely to have a job. And it's because they've been producing college graduates, but they've not liberated an economy to be able to produce the kinds of jobs that a college graduate would need. There's an enormous amount of unrest. There's an enormous amount of built-up social energy that led literally to a revolution. That's why I found an article very, very interesting. It was in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, but it originated in the Austin American Statesman. It's by John Kelso. And here's the headline. Would a rate hike on apps start the revolution? This is what he says. What will it take to push American college students into caring about the budget crisis? Okay, you're going to love this, folks. Now, this is coming from Austin, Texas, the city which is the home to the University of Texas, one of America's premier state universities. Austin is, of course, also the seat of Texas state government. But if you're there and you visit Austin, you're going to notice the student culture that largely dominates in that metropolitan area. Okay, so here is what John Kelso is arguing. He says this, let's face it, there are some real issues that should have our college kids rioting on the road already. He actually says this. He says, take this $10,000 college degree that's part of the Texas's new Rickonomics package named after Governor Rick Perry. Charging $10,000 for a college degree as if you could get a degree with clout for that kind of money. Okay, it goes on and on and on. He asked the question, so I wonder, what would it take to get young Americans worked up enough to protest high unemployment, out-of-sight tuition costs, talk of eliminating Pell Grants and the like? He says maybe it would take a tax on apps. Maybe it would take something that would get the attention of young people. Well, maybe, Mr. Kelso, you're completely out to lunch. If you think for a moment that there's some analogy between the situation of rather pampered American college students on the one hand who experience all the opportunities of a democratic form of government and what's going on in Tunisia and in Egypt, you're either not playing with a full deck or you're willfully misrepresenting the reality here. Now, there is a high degree of unemployment, an unacceptable degree of unemployment in this country. So what do we do? What good would it do for American college students or recent college graduates to go out and protest? The answer to this is what the people, those young people in Egypt and Tunisia actually want, and that is a thriving economy that will produce the jobs they need. They did not riot in the streets in order to get international attention, in order to have CNN and all the rest of the international media descend to talk about their plight. They were in the streets because they want to force a change that would allow an economic expansion that would give them the jobs that they so desperately need. I look at this and I realize when people talk about the bleeding heart media and how out to lunch they are and distant they are from where most people are, I guess nothing comes more clearly to my mind than an article by an opinion writer wondering why American college students aren't out in the streets. Just ask them. Now, speaking of young people, there's another article that certainly had my attention. It comes from the Chicago Tribune by Heidi Stevens. The headline is this: technology can blur teenagers' view of cheating. Now, what does this have to do with? It has to do with the fact that as teenagers are using all these new technologies, especially texting and digital media and all the rest, they're kind of fudging on what cheating means. Let me read to you directly from her report. She says, in a recent poll of more than 2,000 students and parents, Common Sense found that many teens aren't clear about what constitutes cheating. 23%, for example, said storing notes on a phone to access during a test is not cheating. And 19% said downloading a paper from the internet to turn in as your own is not cheating. Well, when you start looking at this, you realize that we're still pretty much where we began, aren't we? Where human beings have an opportunity to cut a shortcut, where human beings have the opportunity to avoid doing the hard work, where human beings are given the opportunity to, let's use the words used here, cheat. Many of them will. Now, the surprise here is that anyone is surprised by this. I mean, after all, we're the people who know you have to have policemen on the streets. We're the people who know you have to have laws on the books. We're the people who know that you have to have parents in the home. And so we shouldn't be surprised that where there is an opportunity to do that which is the shortcut, that which cheats, people will take the opportunity. Oh, and by the way, you're going to love another headline from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Now, get this. This came in a very serious conversation in the premier periodical of the academic world. Here's the headline: guilt is not enough to keep students from texting in class. Oh, my word. Someone needs to text a bit of reality to anyone who's surprised by that headline. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. Follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.